The opinions expressed on End Time do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Impro Mafia. But just because I'm wholly accountable for my actions isn't going to stop me.
Impro Mafia presents End Time! Welcome to End Time, a podcast for improvisers and aspiring improvisers. I'm Dan Beeston, Impro Mafia's second in command.
And I'm David Massingham, Impro Mafia's guy who's near a microphone at the moment.
Welcome to End Time again, Dave. It's been a long time since we've had you on the show.
I think
it's been a long time since we had anyone on the show.
I think the last time I was on was about a year ago.
Yeah.
And I think the last one that you put online full stop was about 3 months, 2 months.
Yeah, all right. No need to rub it in. No need to salt the wounds.
And you brought it up.
Now, we should probably catch up on all the fun impro news that's happened in Brisbane over the last couple of months.
Many things have happened.
Indeed. Pretty much, first and foremost, you went down to Sydney to be a part of the Nationals.
Yes, in Brisbane news, I went to Sydney.
Yes.
I left.
That's the news, you left.
With Tom Dunstan, Natalie Bohensky, and Tristan Ham.
Yep.
So we had two slices of ham. It was awesome.
Massingham and Tristan Ham.
Yeah, I was actually reflecting with Greg.
And some lovely Bohensky sausage.
Yeah.
Ooh, maybe I shouldn't call her that.
No, you shouldn't. No. That's terrible.
That's not good.
Don't do that. I was actually reflecting with Greg Robotham the other day that we should have a three ham show, which is just us three, me, Tristan, and him on stage. We'll do something awesome. We just don't know what it is yet.
Right.
I'm sure it will be ribald and over the top with gregarious characters and scenery chewing aplomb. Yes, we went down to Sydney for the Nationals, the Theatre.
Now, you went down the year previous, too.
With Natalie and Tom then, yes. Mm-hmm. Tristan wasn't there that time. But, yeah, no, they invited Impro Mafia people back, which is great. And so, I think the general strategy was, we'll send down people who know what to expect this time, and then next time we'll send down, you know, at least, I don't know what the plan is.
It's like a frog going into water. You can't just throw a frog into hot water, but you put it into cold water, and then you slowly raise the temperature of the water. So
that is exactly the analogy that was first presented to me when the strategy
was the Sydney Nationals would be the frog and you guys are the cold water and it heats up.
Well, aren't we the frog?
No, they're the frog. You're the hot water because you'll kill the frog.
Well, can't,
if you're bad.
Surely we're the ones who are the more likely to die. The sports Nationals have been going for years now. They'll be fine without, you know, us coming in and screwing things up.
No, you could ruin it. Okay. I think this is the problem.
Oh,
isn't
I see
it?
What you're saying. Yes, yes, yes.
You could go down there and you could kill the frog.
Our ropeable talent.
Yes.
If you could use the word talent.
Yes.
Could potentially.
No, actually, it's not like a frog at all. It's more like a fish.
Uh huh.
Because you put a fish into the cold water and it dies.
Yeah, yeah.
But you warm up the water first, and then you put the fish in. So you guys are the warm water, and Sydney is the fish.
Mm-hmm.
And then if, say, for instance, we need to put someone else in there,
uh-huh.
we put someone who's cold,
uh-huh.
but we put a little bit of cold in with the warm, and it doesn't kill the fish.
Yes. Well, let's just drop the animal analogy and just...
it's like two bears
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
a goat.
Uh-huh. In what way? Anyway, yes, we went down there and performed. Actually, this is the first year that the Theatre Sports Nationals that they had, because they had the states of South Australia and the territory of ACT.
Sons of bitches.
They managed to get their foot in the door and scramble inside.
Well, you would have made short change of them, I'm sure.
Yes, you would have thought so, wouldn't you? No, actually, it was not the most glorious showing for poor Queensland.
So I might understand then that you continued on in the good old Queensland tradition of getting kicked out first.
In the first round, yes.
Ooh, nice.
Yes.
Nice.
Not in the first round, rather. Nice. The third round is actually an elimination format. The first half, all six teams, which include also Victoria, New South Wales, and Perth. And the six teams all played all the way through the first half. And then the second half, at the end of the first half, two teams got culled. Mm-hmm. And it was us and the home team, to be fair. New South Wales were
really?
Also slashed.
Really? New South Wales went out?
Yes, yes.
I remember seeing a New South Wales player posting a somewhat... frustrated blog post not long after that.
Well, I wouldn't know anything about that. Actually, I really don't know anything about that. And then in the second half, they had another elimination halfway through, and it ended up being Victoria, who I think generally win this thing anyway. First time as ACT. ACT came in second place.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, they were really strong. Really lovely to watch them play.
Oh, great.
Yeah. It's great. It was a great night all around. The fact that people got eliminated in the first half doesn't reflect on the fact that of the quality of them, that all six teams were playing really well. played some really lovely impro. There was some really nice supportive playing, people jumping up into each other's scenes, doing whatever they needed to make that scene look as great as possible. And it was really a pleasure to be part of it. Maybe not quite as much of that sort of stuff as it was the first year that I was there. There was numerous scenes with 16 people in it in 2009. But 2010 was still a very, very fun year.
And so how were the parties?
The party was at actually at Casa de Queensland. Everybody came back to Queensland's apartment.
Ah, right.
Which
meant that you couldn't escape the party.
Yes, but that was fine. I didn't really feel the need to.
But you didn't have to drive back to your place abode either.
No, no.
Although that's the great thing about
everybody was at the same hotel complex.
It is so rare that I can go to a party where someone will drive me home these days.
Yeah.
And that's why I love going interstate.
See, you should just be like me. Just don't drive.
Yeah.
It's a cunning plan that works out well for this guy. For the benefit of the listeners, I'm poking my thumbs at myself.
Yes, two thumbs up.
But yeah, no, the parties were great.
So, all in all, 6 out of 10, 10 out of 10.
Or you...
Fuck you, Sydney, we're not coming back.
No, no.
You kick us out in the third round.
No, no, that was all fine. it was a 10 out of 10, clearly. 10 out of 10.
You are always so politically correct when you're on tape. Uh-huh. You don't trust me to edit out the bad stuff.
And why? Why would I?
Good reason.
I haven't seen any or heard any evidence to suggest that I should trust you on that score.
Ah, oh dear. All right, what have we got next on the books? Oh, the musical West Side Story.
Yes, that took place mid-May, and that was directed by Michael Griffin and starring various singing people, and that was sort of based on West Side Story.
Yes, so Bronx gangs.
Singing
at each other.
Yeah. And that was a heaps of fun show. I really enjoyed watching that, yeah. They started off quite nicely by getting offers from the audience, which informed what beef these two gangs had with each other. And it was quite, I thought, a really nice, simple choice that they went with was one gang was really messy.
Cultured.
Messy. One gang was really cultured and had very fine table manners. And the other gang, were despicable and ugly and used their fingers and put their elbows on their table and they did bad.
Tried their hands on dogs.
Yes, that was a recurring theme, thanks to Tom Dunstan. That was
He was amazing. Magic in that.
He was.
He was really enjoyable to watch.
Someone else who was also very good was Kirsten McCauley, who made her Impro Mafia debut, I believe, she's a player from way back in the day.
Yeah, it's nice to see her treading the boards.
Yeah, and she was really enjoyable as sort of the romantic lead who got viciously stabbed at the end.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of, you know, Romeo and Juliet territory, so... Yeah. But yeah, no, I really enjoyable show.
There wasn't enough click fighting for my liking.
Not enough click fighting.
Not enough dancing.
To be fair, there was no click fighting.
There was no dancing.
There was numerous stabbings. But there was no actual, yeah.
Look, if I want numerous stabbings, I'll watch...
The Wire? Do they stab people in The Wire? I haven't seen The Wire. I know I'm meant to.
Prison Break? Prison Break. Oh, it's Prison Break.
I don't know. I've seen Prison Break. Is there shankings in Prison Break?
There's shankings. Oh, yeah.
I'm trying to remember now.
Yeah, yeah.
I just mainly just remember escapings.
Oh, well, yeah. Well, the main character did that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the other characters...
No, a whole bunch of them escaped at the end of the first season, and then you stopped watching because the rest of it's not very good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I struggled for another season.
Yeah, no, I started watching this only a couple of years ago, so I just knew that I should just stop at the end of season one.
I need to get onto Wikipedia and just fill in the blanks.
Yeah, yeah. I believe season two was tolerable. Three just went completely off the rails. But anyway, shankings. Should have been more of them.
Should have been more shankings. Yeah. No. Plenty of shankings. Should have been more click fighting.
Yes. Yes. That's true. I would have been okay with a couple more shankings as well, even though it was fairly high on the shank level for an Impro Mafia show. Two is higher than average. But I could have done with four or five.
Oh.
Actually, one thing I did like about that show in particular was, first of all, really lovely singing. Some really nice song styles that were taught by Luke Rimmelswein, I believe. He got people to experiment with terminology.
There are
terminology,
a lot of song formats.
Yeah, formats.
And we tend to
patter
do one
like
or
that.
Two of them
yeah.
in our general shows. And we don't tend to commit to rehearsing songs and stuff. And when I was in the first musical, we actually started to experiment.
Did we ever mention them in the podcast?
No, we never got around to it. I organized with Chris Anderson like four times to record a podcast about One Bride for Seven Brothers.
Yes.
And every time something went awry and we never ended up discussing it.
That
and
time
now
that
no
I,
one
that I shanked him so like he couldn't make it
yes,
in. Yeah.
The shanking threw a spanner in the works.
Yeah. But either way, there was another musical show. It was really good. Then they've had a second one. It was really good too. Yay. That's the basic history of the musical shows.
It's the rehearsals where they actually get to experiment with different song formats and came up with a whole bunch of rather clever song formats that we hoped to be able to use on stage. And I think it only happened once or twice in the first musical, and it seemed to be a little bit more honed in this musical,
mm.
culminating with a wonderful duet between Kirsten McCauley and Luke Allen.
Who was the romantic lead.
Yeah, and they did a wonderful job of that. And then another one with Tom Dunstan and Joel Gilmore that worked out quite well as well.
Yeah.
Wonderful playfulness and a sort of a certain layers added to the storyline there and to the characters' motivations.
Yeah, no, I recall
that. That was one problem I had with that show, is that a lot of the characters' motivations in it seemed a bit... Well, they seemed really, really obvious, and then Tom was able to bring in a certain subtlety that was really picked it up and made for a much more playful and interesting dynamic between the two groups.
I suppose I see what you mean. I mean, you could say it was obvious, but, like, it's telling a story that, like, not telling a story, but it's riffing on a story that everybody knows, and so, of course, there's going to be some degree of, like, this gang hates another one because that's what they do. Gangs hate each other. It's the way they roll. But, yeah, no, I know what you mean. Tom definitely did really love their work with Joel Gilmore in particular, like, their sort of off-starter leader of the gang versus Minion sort of banter was really lovely.
I mean, this is something that I'm always preaching about, especially to rookies, is that good contrast in your characters will drive entertaining moments on stage.
Entirely, yeah, that's completely true. And actually, another scene that was really strong, it was the opening scene in that show, which did a really lovely job of setting the mood between these two gangs and introducing all the members of the gangs. The way they started is they had Tom, the leader of one gang, coming out, and Amy, who was playing the leader of the other gang, come out, and they kind of sung a song about each other and then introduced the next member of the gang and how they heard about this member of the other gang called Drive-In, which was Joel's character, and then Drive-In sang a bit of a pitter-patter song, and that introduced...
So they endowed character. Each other's characters to some extent.
And it was this really nice back and forth opening to the show, which really did a strong job of introducing the characters, introducing the world, and really setting up a strong platform for the rest of the show to build off, which I thought was really lovely. Mm. And then the other thing I think probably of note for that show is that it was probably the first one for a while, at any rate, that went dramatically dark at the end, which I think we're probably going to talk about in more detail when we get to the next show. At the very end of the show, went from lovey-dovey musical to Shanks Ahoy when Kirsten got shanked.
Yep, the main
and the main guy just pissed off.
Luke
Allen just went, everyone said, get out of town. He goes, all right. And he did. It wasn't a friendly moment at all. And you could see, like, the cast members on stage going, this is a, you know, different sort of an ending for this show. It's kind of fun. Speaking to them afterwards, I got the impression, like, because you think, oh, it's West Side Story style thing, of course, it's going to be a bit... Oh, not West Side Story. Does that end happily or badly? They change it to be happy, don't they? I don't watch musicals.
No, I'm not sure.
Well, either way, Romeo and Juliet, I know this one.
Yeah.
That one's definitely bad.
I watched almost 90% of that film. It was beautiful. Yeah. Very, very happy. Yeah. No, it was good.
Yeah, it was heartrending.
I saw there's such a fun kids film called Old Yellow, too. Oh, my goodness, yeah. Fun little dog.
Yeah, that epic drama, Milo and Otis. Got me right here. Actually, it did when I found out they killed, like, 20 cats making that film. But, yeah, no, that was really effective at the very end when it was quite a nice gear shift, and it was nice to finish a show on a different sort of a note to wild, ribald comedy that we usually do.
Well, that's a great thing. If you could play drama really effectively on impro stage, then the impro itself will bring the entertainment and the chaos and the ridiculous.
Yeah. But if you can get the audience leaving the theatre going, actually, you know what, that was kind of touching there at the end, or that was... If you get them thinking about something other than the fact that they've just been laughing and having a time, that's a plus, I think.
Yeah.
You get them engaging with the character on that level, characters rather on that level, that's exciting.
Which brings us, rather neatly, to Untopia, which is my very first proper directed long form.
Second, isn't it? You directed...
I directed Touched by a Hammer, but I was forced into it. And this is the first one where I...
Okay, you know how before we were talking about how I'm very political on the podcast, and when it's a microphone near me, I won't badmouth anyone. Who forced you into this horrible role?
I was very happy with the original Touched by a Hammers.
Now, they were done at the Satchmo's space back in, like, 06 or something, weren't they? Like, way back in the day.
The original idea was Touched by an Angel of Death, which was Jesus and God traveling small town America.
Solving people's problems.
Solving people's problems, Touched by an Angel style, or Highway to Heaven. And that was directed by Oisin Raymond.
Oh, wow, yes. I remember Oisin, yes.
Mm. And we did another season. Oisin wasn't involved, and then some of the players weren't involved. And then one of the new players who came in was a devout religious type, and was very anxious about us possibly doing more scenes that involved Jesus sodomizing the devil, which I think is how the previous show ended up. and
show, not shows.
Just one show.
Just one show ended up with Jesus, demon sex. Yeah. Okay.
So on the night, Alistair Crawford just went, "All right, we'll just change it. So it'll be Odin and Thor."
And thus,
and so he was happy to make fun of Odin and Thor, someone else's gods. What do you expect from someone called Adam?
So you have badmouthed somebody on this podcast.
Yes.
I hope Adam's not listening.
I don't care. You silly god bother. God botherer. Get back to church. That's where all the damage is done. Yeah. At any rate, so I was very happy with it because we did, I think, 3 episodes of Touched by a Hammer and Thor got more and more ridiculously stupid as we went by. I played Thor.
Yes, and Luke Grimmelswein was playing Odin, is that correct? Or am I making
that? Nope. Liam Burrow was playing Odin, and Alistair played Loki.
Yes.
And so, gosh, we're talking about the wrong long form here, but...
I don't even recall liking that one.
Yeah, well, it was... the big problem was that they made me come... They kind of decided that they were going to do it again, with me in it or not, and I was quite attached to the character of Thor, and so they made me do it again down at the Pie High, and it was an abomination. It was such an awful show. And I was very against it. And then Wade decided to put it on as a long form at the Brisbane Arts Theatre.
Second long form at the Brisbane Arts, I think. Yeah. The first one was The Wake. And then that was the one straight afterwards, if memory serves. And the last one of 08.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I thought The Wake was last.
No. All Wake was definitely the first one, first show I did after coming back from a break.
All right, then. Yes, so we did a long form at the Brisbane Arts Theatre. And it went all right.
Yeah, look, yeah, it went okay. I don't have hugely fond memories of it, but it certainly wasn't bad.
The best thing that happened,
but I don't think we have done a bad long form there.
The best thing that happened from Touched by a Hammer was that I managed to rope in Chris Anderson to play keyboards for us.
First one for Chris,
and he loved it, and he loved the whole experience, and he loved meeting everyone from Infomafia, and now.
He can't get out.
Can't get out.
He's locked. He's locked in our warm embrace. Yes. We're holding him close with our bosoms collectively. He's not getting out.
So he was playing the keyboards for Untopia, the show that I directed.
And what? What are we talking about?
Yes, Untopia, a dystopian epic film about a future that is a bureaucratic nightmare.
Not film. Improvised play.
But the special effects and the sets were so amazing. You could be forgiven for thinking it was a film.
By special effects, do you mean the party poppers?
Party poppers.
And Tristan's magic skills.
Oh, my God.
Which we only discovered he had during the show. we should probably backtrack a bit and explain exactly what this show was about and
now,
who was involved.
This show stemmed from... A lot of our improvised shows over the last year have been quite successful, I think mostly because we've had a strong narrator. Long form's the biggest danger with a long form is that you need to keep everyone on the same page. Everyone needs to know what they're doing on stage,
yes,
or be on the same page as far as what environment they're in,
yep,
or maybe what motivations people have.
Mm.
And when you've got someone who is making that call and who is thinking one scene ahead, then you've got a whole bunch of your bases covered. So, because the problem is, in a long form, if the players get off stage and then goes, where do we go next? There's someone whose job it is to know what's going to happen next, or at least whose job it is to make it up.
I don't think that's necessarily the only way of doing it. It's a way that we've done with some of our shows was just worked for, but then there's other shows that we've done where we haven't done that so much, and it's worked quite strongly. Like,
There are 100 different ways to do it.
Like, it's also, like, I think some people could make the argument that, you know, having someone off stage is who's there to say, go there next, like, could be limiting in terms of
the improv. That's the thing. There are 100 different ways that you can introduce chaos into an improv show. I'm of the mindset that if you can have a couple of things that the players can be really confident about is being controlled, then that gives other opportunities to be chaotic and
let yourself off the leash. Yeah, yeah. And it's also partly like just getting a format into your head and being confident in the format and test driving the format and finding out whether, you know, pushing and pulling at bits of the corners of the format in rehearsals, and then you'll discover where there's like a big gaping Guatemalan sinkhole, which you might fall through if you do something stupid on stage in front of an audience. It's that testing sort of thing of working at what works with the format that can really give you that confidence to be completely stupid and silly on stage.
Yeah. But in Safe Prog Death, we have Greg on the side of stage doing proper sort of radio play style switches to
Later in the conservatory.
Later in St. Love Forest and Arboreum, Nurse Buble ponders her relationship with Dr. Mangold, and suddenly everyone's on the exact same page about how this scene is starting. No one knows how it's going to end, but every single scene has a setup an anchor that they can spring from. And so no one's confused as to where they are in the moment out there. And they can all move it out together from the same point. A very similar thing for the radio play that you did last year.
Yes, though, to be fair, in the second half, like Luke Rimmelswine, who was the narrator-style person in that show, he pretty much, for the most part, just gave like fairly blind offers and just chucked them out there. And I mean, it's the same sort of thing. Like you get a blind offer of Meanwhile at the Well, Tommy's drowning.
And suddenly that's a big thing to get everyone on the same page and something that the performers don't have to worry about. So they can think about the characters or doing a Welsh lisp.
Yes, that was on, depending on what's thrown at them by the other wankers, I mean improvisers.
And then it sort of culminated with the by the book shows where the
which narrator, were heavily narrated shows.
Heavily narrated. Natalie would be on stage playing the character of the authoress and writing the story and being able to alter the story from outside of it, but as a character on stage, and which was a really marvellous way of going about it.
And that's also similar for the first half of Agatha Holmes as well, which was last June. That was I narrate my character, the Watson-esque character, narrates in the first half.
Indeed.
It hopefully sets up enough stuff there that I don't need to do any narration in the second half.
Yes. And so I kept thinking about this and how we've got characters who sort of writing a story on stage, but we always tend to get our offers by passing out sheets of paper before the show. And I've always shied away from that a little bit, just because I love proving to the audience that everything is being made up on the spot and really showing how clever the performers are.
Yes. It was a catch-22. I think part of the reason why the paper thing was introduced for a lot of long forms is so that you don't break the bubble of the world in the first couple of minutes of the show.
Indeed.
Which is great. But then if you can find a way of organically introducing an offer-grabbing scene into the show, that's great too, is what happened with Untopia.
That's pretty much where I jumped off from. This is how I came to the format, is that I went, how would I narratively fashion a way to make the audience decide things in the show that works as part of the story?
Well, outline Untopia for those who didn't see it and how you did that.
The world is set up so that all the characters have a personal decision-making device on their arm, which turned out to be really, really useful because it's the sort of thing that could really change a culture and make your main characters look a little bit weak and like they need to escape that. And your character, Gus, had his own computer system, the iHelp.
He did.
And the audience members
were the components.
They were the processing units. They were the ones who made the decision. And so I came out as the system bus to help them make the decision and introduce everything to them and get them to make decisions whenever your character turned to the computer for help. So it was a completely organic way of making the audience a part of the story and making their decisions important to where the story was headed.
Yeah, and that's what I found really exciting about the show, is playing with this different format and trying to see how that could influence the way that the direction the story took. I know that something that you were very keen on was because we were dealing with a dystopian sort of science fiction parable sort of storyline type thing, and these things always turn out badly for the protagonist.
Yep.
If you watch, Brazil, or if you read 1984 or Fahrenheit 451 or any of those sorts of things, it's always pretty shit in the end. Lobotomies, death.
Well, the dystopian future, thematically, it's about tragedy and loss and being overpowered.
And being this close. It's like getting a bit of hope, a bit of a carrot being dangled in front of the protagonist's face and then being snatched away, and usually half their brain gets snatched away as well. And I know one thing that you said that you were very keen to do, which ties in with that sort of idea of the dystopian future, which always ends badly for the main character, is that you wanted the audience to be making decisions for my character in the first half, and then at the end of the second half, when everything goes pear-shaped, want the audience to suddenly go, you know what? We didn't put him in a good place here. If we had been nicer, if we maybe said towed the line of this dystopian world and said, instead of saying, go chase the girl or talk to that revolutionary, then this guy wouldn't have, in the case of the show, as it ended up, be about to be decapitated.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun because I really hoped that the audience... I kind of suspected the audience would do that. They'd want to put him in the shit, but I couldn't have guessed at just how wonderfully and effectively that would have worked.
I'm curious. I hope that idea was clear at the end of the show. I talked to a couple of people afterwards and they said, oh, yeah, no, that's true. I didn't think of that. Yeah, we clearly did put him in the shit, but they didn't necessarily think about it at the time. So I'd like to, I don't know, not necessarily with Untopia, but I'm sure that we can take different format ideas from Untopia, and in future long forms we do play with that sort of idea, because that was something that I really liked about Untopia in particular, that idea that the audience really screwed it up for the main character.
Yeah, and that's the wonderful thing, because as an audience member of a dystopian film, you're watching it and you're excited by the dangers that the character is put into, and you get excited when he goes after the girl and you want that to happen. And it's those things that you enjoy and that you derive pleasure from that are ultimately his downfall.
Yes.
And this is just adding an extra step where the audience is now responsible for what's happened. So I was really happy that that came off so effectively. And I did have the Sean Dowling came up and said, oh, I got it, and I realized that we're to blame.
Oh,
like,
cool.
Oh, someone got it.
I actually heard someone say specifically that they got that, so I'm very glad to hear that, yeah.
Yeah.
I heard lots of people. It was an interesting show in terms of the reaction that it got. It's like some people, I think everybody at the very least came away from going, that was cool, that was different. There was, even if they didn't really necessarily dig it that much, when I liked that wasn't, you know,
the same as always.
Wasn't like something else I'd seen before.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people who were really familiar with that sort of genre were really happy with it, really liked it a lot.
Well, I actually had one audience member come up and tell me that he believed that Huxley and Orwell would have been looking down and smiling.
I think I had the same person say the same thing to me. I know who you're talking about.
It was so sweet.
Yeah.
Very touching.
And then there's other people who I think most people liked it, who thought, you know, it wasn't quite, didn't quite get the strongest version of the particular form that we had.
Yeah.
But the form was strong enough that it was like still a strong show.
Yeah. And I think
which is kind of where I sit. We did four rehearsals, I think, actually. The first two were largely just talking so that we were all on the same page as to how this world works, how this format works, all that sort of stuff. Then the next rehearsal, we did a pretty stunning run of it. Not a full run, but, you know,
we did the first half and just the characters,
we were very, very happy with it. And the world was created very strongly and it was very nicely realized. And the second run was pleasingly crap, or at least crapper, which was good because you want to be able to discover those mistakes in the rehearsal. The actual run that we did in front of an audience was somewhere between those two.
Yeah.
It wasn't fantastic, but it certainly wasn't bad. It was good. It was solid. Yeah. It was fine.
And the audience really
had highs and it had lows, blah, 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 all that sort of stuff. And the audience enjoyed it. I was happy with it, but it wasn't as much as I hoped for from the show, I think. But that doesn't
matter. I was just glad it wasn't a failure.
Well, I think even if it was a failure, though, I'd much rather do a show that is exciting and interesting and bizarre that fails than something that's safe, that's kind of, you know, entertaining-ish.
Yes. I was quite terrified when I realised exactly what I'd taken on. Because impro, we know how to do wacky and silly, and then to do something where there's like one laugh in the last 10 minutes of the show, but you still want to keep the audience interested. It's something that we're not 100% confident with. It's something that we don't do enough of.
Yeah.
And it's really nice that it all came together so well in the night. So I couldn't be happier. Could not be happier, except if it was brilliant.
that's how I
that
could
be happier. Be happier.
I could be happier. But yeah, no, it was definitely an enjoyable show.
Indeed.
Oh, and also, yeah, sorry, just briefly on those special effects we were talking about before. This particular world, one of the offers we got at the beginning was that
science,
this world was...
and stuff.
Obsessed with science and stuff, which meant that when the revolutionary appeared, he had to be representative of something that wasn't science. It had to be the opposite of science. So Tristan, the revolutionary, came on, and he was advocating the use of magic. And he pulled out these little, you know, I suspect probably fairly simple sleights of hand sort of tricks, but they were really damn impressive to people who weren't expecting them.
Making a card disappeared is really impressive.
And as he dies, it's probably my favorite moment of the entire show. As he dies, he calls me over and goes, come over here. And he holds up this coin in his hand and goes, watch the coin. And he makes it disappear and it's gone. Poof. And then he collapses back. And he dies at the same moment that the coin disappears. Wonderful moment. My face was an inch or two from his hand and I could not see how he did it. He showed me afterwards and it was really easy to spot. But at the time...
That's a magician's thing. Never do a trick twice.
Yeah.
Because people start looking for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I thought the best trick on the evening was suddenly having a deck of cards available.
Yes, it just so happened that we were lucky. We lucked into having the right random objects around the theatre at that time to use for the show.
Yeah.
Cards and
some tinfoil.
Tinfoil, which worked out for...
Silver balls.
Silver things. And it's much too complicated to go into why that was important, but it was important.
And party poppers. I just happened to have a bag full of party poppers because I needed a single one, and I think all of them got used during the show.
Yeah. Every time a trick happened, there was this magical pop. No, good show.
I think the nicest thing that I heard was that after the show, there were a bunch of people discussing how on earth they would take Untopia and turn it into a multi-night show. like a 3-night or a 6-night show? Like, how would they go about it?
Wow, I don't know if you can.
Yeah, and I went, and I thought to myself, no fucking way. No way in hell am I doing that again.
Yeah.
But it was very nice to think that people enjoyed it so much that they wanted to see it again.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing that people enjoyed so much they wanted to see again was Agatha Holmes.
Agatha Holmes.
And they get to see it again.
They do. And in much the way that you just described it. Agatha Holmes is a one-off show that we did in June 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And people liked it. And now we're doing a 2-week season, a la what we've done with Prog Death in the past. So, you know, six shows.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's been fun. Like, it's that's starting next week. So I don't know when this is going to air or go into the net.
It's July 1st. Is that right?
It starts July 1st. Thursday,
July 1st.
And it goes till July 10th, Thursdays to Saturday nights. And the season passes and what have you available. You can check that out on our website. But it's been quite fun progressing that format into something that's going to work in a 6-night run, as opposed to just a one-off.
It is basically the same story, because it's a murder mystery.
It's a murder mystery, and of course, the way that we did the first time is that we had the five suspects, and there was a form that the audience filled in at the beginning, and they circled who... They had a bunch of names that meant, you know, for all intents and purposes to them, nothing.
Yep.
And they were asked to circle one name, and those ones were tallied up, and that was the victim. And there was another portion where you circled the murderer. And so one of the five main characters was killed. Completely killed. And you obviously can't do that every night of a 6-night run, because if you kill off each one of your main characters each night, you're going to have like two left by the second week. So it was fun kind of trying to think of a way to develop that and make it so you can still have these same characters coming back night in, night out. So people who come more than once can get involved with these characters that are on stage and see how they progress. But at the same time, it's a murder mystery. Someone's got to die. You can have a resetting universe, but for me, that wasn't quite as satisfying.
Yep.
So what we're doing is we're actually getting the regular cast. There's a regular cast of five suspects. There's Agatha Holmes, the main detective, and there's his assistant Wastings, myself. And then each night there'll be guests who may or may not die.
They're gonna die. Cop it sweet.
You're gonna cop it sweet.
Yes. Right. Well, my character is.
Yeah. Yeah. No. You know, we're gonna kill you.
Son of a gun.
Yes. Well, not necessarily gun yet. It could be something else.
Mm-hmm.
Last time, Michael Griffin was killed with a bowl of trifle. So
yes,
he was found face down in a bowl of trifle.
But I understand that you've considered various tropes of the murder mystery genre.
Oh yes, completely. Yeah. So there's
because I always think of a murder mystery being You know, someone dies and then there's people gathering around a table and lots of accusations and some lipstick found under the stairs and something.
And look, but all of these things could happen.
But there's more to it when you look into the thing.
Oh, there's heaps more. Definitely, yeah.
There are a lot of various tropes.
Hugely, yeah.
For different types of murders and solutions and such.
Yeah, different sort of characters that turn up, different sorts of twists, different sorts of all sorts of things. So, yeah, I've actually done up a big document that I've sent out to everybody in the cast. It's kind of like, these are things that could happen. You know, the murderer might murderer might dress up in somebody else's clothes to set off an alibi for some particular reason. And I'm not saying that these things will happen. It's just to get people thinking about them in their head. So,
is there anything else that you've had to do in order to make it a 6-night show over a 1-night show?
Yes, there's...
I imagine one great thing is that with a new character each night, you get to develop all of the relationships that character has with all the main characters.
Definitely, yeah.
And that basically, that makes the first half of your show, and then you get to deal with...
Yeah, well, essentially the way the show runs is the first half is my character, the Watson, narrating to the other character, the detective character, Gregory Rotham's Agatha Holmes, narrating what has happened in the lead up to a murder. And so the first half is essentially, just watching the guest character interact with these new characters, develop motives, separate motives, all these characters and all the sort of storylines that could coalesce around those characters before culminating in a vicious murder. And the second half is once he, gets in there and investigates. That core sort of format is pretty much the same as the last format that we did.
Yep.
There wasn't really a need to change that up about. It's more sort of like allowing these characters to breathe and finding ways that... Because there was some people after the first show, although a lot of people after the first show said, should I really like to see that again? That would be great. And a number of them in the cast said that as well. And there was almost immediately there was talk of that one's likely to have a good chance of coming back to season. And even then, though, people were like, but how is it going to be different each night? Because people think, murder, as you said before, murder mystery is the same.
Yeah. And someone dies. someone solves the crime.
Yeah.
There's a little, there's more intricacies there, though.
Yeah, yeah, and it is about, like, there's one night, I won't go into too much detail, but, like, there will probably be one night which is more maybe tied a bit around blackmail, for example, in this current run. So if we're looking at theming shows in different particular ways, and that should allow a lot of variety to the run. Greg Robotham's got some great ideas about how to keep Agatha Holmes, the character, fresh from night to night. Let's just say that.
And pickling?
Then, what's that, sorry?
Pickling. You can pickle him and he'll be fresh each night.
Yes, yes.
That was pretty much his go last time round.
Yeah, yeah, just getting drunk and that's how he solved the crime. It's like pulling out copious amounts of white powder and then sniffing that until he got to the murderer.
The other fun thing about this, of course, and this is what happened last time, is that Greg has no idea who the murderer is.
Yeah, like it's
he's
originally
supposed to solve the crime.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. It's an hour-long game of endowments.
Mm, yeah, and we didn't make it entirely clear, I think, last time that Greg really had no idea what was going on whatsoever. But this
he
time
he still has no idea.
He
what
really
happening.
Does not have any idea whatsoever. But this time, I'm going to make it very clear, and hopefully, anybody who comes along should be able to see that Greg never leaves the audience's sight throughout the entire show. From the very since before the doors open, he comes out and he's standing outside in the courtyard at the Arts Theatre, chatting to people beforehand.
You see, people are not going to believe it though. People will find.
They won't believe it.
Must have signs. You must have like a little sign, like someone raises their fingers a certain way and that shows who the
And look, and actually, somebody in rehearsal suggested that we do something like that and I was like, no, we're not. If Greg has to go through every single person on, you know, night three, if he goes through each person, points wildly at them and says, that guy's the murderer. No, okay, well, maybe it's her. That's okay. I don't want him to have any hints or clues or anything like that, apart from obviously the narrative's hints and clues and partly also the role of myself as the offsider is to point him towards sort of things. Go, you know, did you notice how the corpse's wig was missing? Wink, wink. Maybe the wig master might have something to say about that.
My dad came along and saw Untopia. It is the second impro show that he's ever seen me in. The first one being a little over a decade ago at the Hub Cafe.
And he's like, you have not improved one bit.
He came out after the show and he said quite earnestly and solemnly, thank you. Thank you so much. And I went, gosh, he really enjoyed the show that much. And he goes, thank you for not picking me to give you an offer because I was so shy. I would have curled up and died if I had to say something out loud. And I'm like, yeah, that sounds like him. And
do you like the show though?
He said, now, the person who said science and stuff, that was a plant, right? No, it's impro theatre. That's how it works.
These people who are really suspicious. Last night, I was sitting with my girlfriend's dad, and we were watching some YouTube videos, and there was this various videos that we watched. Like, one, for example, was a panda throwing some sticks around in sort of this kung fu sort of way.
Yes, seen that.
You've seen that one before. And there was a couple other ones and other, you know, things like that. And after each one, he'd always say, okay, well, there must be somebody off screen, like, doing this, this, and this to try and get the panda to throw the stick in a certain way. It's like, no, it's probably just, you know, it's probably just a panda doing this thing. Like, it's all, every single thing we watch, everything had a reason, everything had, like, a little, there must have been a trick behind it.
Yeah, which, I'm starting to get good at picking fakes, but I saw, like, this little Latino baby, like a...
This is a smoking baby?
No. Like a year and a half old, looked like they're from South America or something. This kid standing up on a table in a diaper, dancing, like, full on Latin American dance move.
Sure.
And I couldn't find any video artifacts that made me think that it was fake, but there was something about this.
Something about it that was fake? Was it the year and a half old baby that was
baby
fake?
Dancing?
Maybe that was it?
You have to see this footage because it is creepy.
I assume it's more convincing than the Ally McBeal stuff from 1997.
It is very convincing, but yeah, there was something about it which made me either... It's fake and someone is very, very good with their soft image or their 3D Studio Max, or that kid is autistic and like high-functioning autistic who only knows how to dance because there is no way that
at 1.5, people don't know what to do. They don't know how to do anything. Babies don't know how to do a single thing at 1.5.
Yeah.
So if they can just do the one that well, that's pretty good.
He stands on one leg. It's creepy. I could barely stand on two at that. No,
you can still barely stand on two.
I'm lying down right now.
You are. Get up. Get off my floor.
I'm dizzy.
I'll kick you out later.
And time. You have been listening to David Massingham. You can catch up with David Massingham online at thesexydetective.com.
Yes, you can.
I'm Dan Beeston. You can listen to my other podcast at smartenough.org.
Yes, you can.
For news about Impro in Brisbane, check out impromafia.com. Thanks to David Peachy for our theme music. Hosting for End Time has been iridescently provided by CivicNet Web Design.
Another thing that is going to happen, which isn't my idea at all, actually, is Greg Robotham's idea.
Do you want to give this away?
I'm not going to give this to War. Oh, yeah, should I? I don't know.
We might just keep that.
Yeah, okay, we'll cut that bit out.
Yeah.
Except— can I trust you to cut that bit out?
No.